It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello and welcome to the Phileas Club, the show where we get people from around the world to basically say hello to everyone. This is episode number 37 for July 2011. Hello and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode number, 37, and it is July 2011, or 2011, as people who know how to speak say it. I am Patrick Beja, your host, and with me today are three wonderful people, one of which just jumped in the call as we were doing the intro. Hello, Tom
Merrick. Can I breathe now?
Yes, now you can breathe.
Oh,
I told Turkey, stop breathing because you're making noise. And he did. So, thank you.
That's cruel and unusual, Patrick.
I'm sorry?
I said that's cruel and unusual.
Not for Turkey. He deserves it.
Oh,
so,
me?
Turkey,
I deserve it for being 20 minutes late.
I might have something even worse in store for you, Merritt.
I'm sorry.
Okay, it's okay. Settle down, Turkey. You're fine. So Turkey, of course, everyone knows him. Tom, I'm sure everyone knows him. The third co-host, though, some people might not already know in this audience. Eric is here with us. Thank you very much for joining.
Losing my virginity on the show here.
Wait, what?
Wow, this is going to get ratings.
You mean your podcasting virginity,
my
right?
Podcasting virginity, of course.
Thank you. Thank God. This is not... I mean, you know, things like that could be arranged, but it would probably be a different kind of thing. So Eric is a friend from the actual world of journalism. And as I'm saying this, I'm realizing that Tom is also a real journalist. Oh, okay. So it works from the actual world of journalism as, he works at a real news TV news station, France 24. And no one says it's not a real TV station. It is.
Yes, it is a real TV station. It actually has cameras and lights and the whole thing.
So you're the guy who's in charge of their internet web social stuff, right?
All the digital gadgets and sites and mobile apps and platforms. And I also host Tech24, which you were very kind to step in my stead, and which is a global technology show, kind of tech for the rest of us, particularly in the developing world where France 24 is most well known, and so all things digital, basically, at France 24.
Cool. Excellent. Thank you very much for being here. And I think people might remember me talking about France 24 a few months ago, several times, you know, because it's really a channel I enjoy, and I think it provides a different view on the world.
Can you just mention the name in English, please?
Well, France 24.
And they also have.
I'm sure there's a lot of people who did not know what you were talking about.
Possibly, yes, that's true. And it's also available in Arabic, so it's really an effort to try and push French propaganda in the world everywhere.
it's French perspectives on the world rather than French propaganda.
What's
and
the name in Arabic?
You're going to stump me on that one, but it is it's in French, English, and in Arabic.
And in Arabic, it said whatever France is in Arabic and 24 in Arabic. So
yeah.
If you care, you probably already know.
Yep, it's France at 24.
Oh, well, there you go. I didn't see. I'm so used to having you in my life, Turkey. Although, you know, I was born in Lebanon, so I should probably know at least that. But, all right. So first of all, two things I need to say before we actually start the show. First of all, very sorry to everyone for not doing a show last month. It just happened. It just we didn't have time, and we actually planned something, but then things didn't work out.
So. I didn't show up to that one at all. So
you weren't the only.
You can blame me. That's fine.
I could, but it wouldn't be accurate. We can also blame other people that I'm not going to name. To be fair, I was in the middle of a whole lot of stuff. So very sorry for not being there, but we're here now.
And I told you in advance I won't make it. So.
You did.
I was one of the people who skipped.
No, you're not. Well, you skipped, but you told me in advance, not at the last second. I'm hearing an echo of myself, so it's a little bit weird. Oh, now it's gone. And the other thing is, another very important thing for me that happened in the past month is that I got engaged.
Yay! So,
congratulations,
dude!
Wow, you guys aren't
Mazel tov.
Everyone here has already told me congratulations several times, so that's why they are not really managing to muster up the enthusiasm of the first initial.
Something. What took you so long?
Oh my God, that's great, Patrick! Congratulations.
Thanks. See, there you go. Now you sound American. But no, it's really something. Obviously, a huge news. I think most people who listen to this show probably follow me on various social networks, and I've been inundating them with the news because I'm so excited and happy. So it's probably not a huge news for these people, but I wanted to talk about this for just a second. And all three of you guys are married, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And Turkey, I know he is, and he's not answering, but yes.
I'm not answering, dude, because I am married. Everybody knows I'm married. I've been over the show talking about it.
That's true. But so what I wanted to talk about was something that happened when I announced that I got engaged, which basically in my world, in my in my single world, in my world of single people, marriage was always described as something kind of, of course you're going to do it and you love the person and everything, but there's also the sentiment of you give up a little bit of your life, and there's the bull and chain sentiment. And then single people, it's always a jungle out there, and it's difficult to find the person you really like, and the girls are clingy and annoying, and the guys are pigs and dirty, and they care only about sports. And, you know, all of that world was sort of what I knew about relationships. And, of course, you had people who would find somebody they love, but they were the very few lucky ones, and then you would get married, but there was joy, but also a lot of things you had to give up, basically. And all of a sudden, when I announced I was getting engaged, the world sort of switched. It was like someone turned on a different light or something. And everyone around me is incredibly happy, and people are sending me messages about how, you know, I've been married for 20 years. It's the best feeling in the world, and it's amazing, and I love it, and you're going to be so happy, and blah, blah, blah. And it's sort of really weird that it got switched so much. Is it my rose-colored glasses that I've put on, or is there some kind of an actual different world for people who are single and people who aren't? Or what is happening there? Do you have any insight from the height of your marriage, all of you?
It's probably evolutionary. You know, the species needs to procreate, so when you get married, it's just built into our genes to encourage that.
Well, it's interesting that are these French people that were telling you this, or non-French people? Because, you know, in France, over half the population isn't married. People get paxed here, they get civil unions, they do all these things. But marriage itself is actually a declining trend in France and in a lot of Europe. So I'm kind of surprised. I think Americans might respond that way. But I'd be surprised if French people responded with the same level of enthusiasm, considering how many people here choose not to get married.
To be honest, it was pretty much everyone from, not everyone, but from everywhere. It was just incredibly positive, happy feelings everywhere, you know? It's not like someone is getting engaged. It's not like you're going to be, yeah, well, welcome to prison, dude. Maybe a couple of people said that in jest, but I understand that obviously you're not going to rain on their parade, but I don't know. It was a strange shift. It doesn't seem to be very inspiring to you guys.
Well, I think maybe you answered your question right there. It's one of those big moments in life that, you know, like graduating from school or you know, moving into your first house and things like that, you know, where people are just like, oh, this is a big moment. I'm not going to rain on your parade. I'm going to congratulate you.
Yeah.
So maybe
and how many of those who were married that told you marriage was a bad idea?
There were a couple of people who were you know, saying it with smileys and stuff, but no, overall it was overwhelmingly positive. And maybe, you know, so maybe it's going to be I'm going to get down from my high in a few weeks, and then I will realize that it's, you know, like everything, you have to work at stuff, and sometimes it's hard, and some. But I don't know. It's
feels a lot of work, Patrick.
It is a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun if you have the right person. So.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure.
And you should always know the wife or the fiancé is always right. Just keep that in mind.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. That's going to be...
that's not an option, Patrick. That's the law.
Lesson number one.
See, but, you know, that's one of the things that I don't want to believe in. I don't want to... That's exactly the kind of thing I was kind of talking about. You know, it's like this... you have to always agree with what she says about this and say goodbye to your, you know, evenings with your friends doing this and that. And there's
Patrick, that's not necessary. It depends on the woman you're married.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
it all comes down to her. For example, my wife, I still have my two cigar nights. We have an agreement. She goes out with her friends. I go to my cigars every twice a week.
Yeah.
So it all comes down to your wife.
Totally. I mean, my wife goes out and does things on her own, and I do things on our own, and it's, you know, that's never been an issue. But the thing about, you know, the other person is always right, I think that is a joke based in the fact that you're going to have arguments and you need to learn how to kind of grant the other person the win in the argument, even when you don't think they're winning, because otherwise you're just going to descend into constant bickering, and that's no fun for anyone.
Yeah, I can see that, and obviously I think, but that's a different, yeah, it's a different thing from they're always right, but I see how that would translate into, yeah, I agree. Okay. Well, so yeah, that was the big news for me, and now let's talk about what's been happening in the world, if you will. And what shall we talk about first? I guess the biggest news in the past week or so we have to address is the horrible attacks in Norway, which have been making the headlines everywhere, I'm sure, around the world. Oh, and by the way, sorry, before we get into that, I completely forgot to tell about Eric's background beyond France 24. He's also you're also a very... you're a specialist in Chinese affairs, right?
Yeah, Chinese, and lived over there for 10 years working for the AP, the alphabet soup of networks, AP, CNN, BBC, CNBC, and then kind of turned a lot of attention to China in Africa, and that's what I tweet on mostly now. And so that's the kind of mix.
Right. Is,
you know, 20 years of journalism kind of in Asia and the U.S. and now in Europe.
So hopefully you can provide something that we've been lacking in this show, which is an outlook somewhat based in China and to an extent in, from Africa.
Absolutely.
Right. So let's move on to the attacks in Norway. So I'm not even going to go into what actually happened. I'm pretty sure everyone knows.
I have to emphasize one thing first.
Okay.
He definitely was not an Arab. He was not a Muslim.
You know, and that brings up one of, I mean, let's start off with the most kind of contentious point of all of what happened is that on Friday, this was a terrorist incident, last Friday, and as soon as we found out that he was, you know, a white and, you know, a Christian fundamentalist and a Norwegian, it turned into an attack, and the word terrorism was dropped. And so one of the things that's been on our, you know, social, across all of our social networks is a huge debate, particularly from the Islamic world, you know, in Europe and in the Middle East, saying, you know, this is complete BS on the part of the media that they changed their narrative. The Guardian then came out with a really high profile editorial and just blasted the mainstream media for, you know, all that speculation that was blatantly false.
And isn't it possible that he would be sentenced under some sort of anti-terrorism law that was recently passed that would allow them to keep him in jail longer than normal law would allow?
What's interesting is they don't even have the vocabulary in their legal system to put this guy away long enough. So they're actually, as you said, they're pulling together, you know, to try to throw as many charges at him as possible to put him in jail for a long time, just because the Norwegians just don't have precedent for any of this.
Yeah, they
actually,
have to cut.
I heard there is a law that where they can put him for life, but that can be extended after the, which is 24 years.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking about. Yeah. It was referred to in the article I read as an anti-terrorism law, but maybe that's not what it's actually called.
No, it is called an anti-terrorism law, which is, again, going back to the irony of how the media changed its vocabulary at U.S.,
yeah, exactly.
Yet at the same time, he's being tried under terrorism. Was this an act of terrorism? Of course
well,
it was.
Well, Eric, you're you know, in the media, in the real media, so maybe you can, and you're denouncing this specifically, so let's ask you, what is it? How is that not an act of terrorism?
It is an act of terrorism, and this was the real problem that we had in our social media presence on France 24, and then we had on the broadcast and the news side. So, on the TV side, they changed their language from.
But okay, but
to
so you know these guys. Why? What? Because I don't want to be completely, you know, thinking they necessarily had evil intents in you know, a political agenda. But why in their minds did this switch from? Is it because just, you know, terrorism is now so strongly associated with Islam, Muslim fundamentalists, or?
Well, in part, when you're writing text in very, very short blurbs, whether it's a headline for TV or on a tweet or on, you know, in a package of a story that's 2 minutes long, you have to use as efficient language as possible. And what they did, and a lot of that language oftentimes is driven by the agencies. That's Reuters, AP, AFP. And what ends up happening is there's just this kind of leitmotif that changes. And people, you know, they felt that using the word terrorism implies Islam, it implies Muslim, it implies foreign, it implies someone other than a domestic threat. Now, in the United States, we went through this after Timothy McVeigh. You know, that was the first that we introduced this idea of domestic terrorism, because prior to that, we didn't really call anything that happened on U.S. soil terrorism. That started to change. Well, that hasn't happened here yet. And I think in the rest of the media, it's caused a lot of consternation, because as soon as we made that change, our Facebook page lit up with, wait, whoa, 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 how can you guys be saying this now when you were saying this yesterday? And I came out on Facebook as the moderator of our English language Facebook community and said, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I think that level of humility on the part of a big global network kind of surprised a lot of people, because they would criticize us. And I said, you were not above that reproach.
Mm. It's okay. To take the other side of the debate here, I sort of, even, you know, when I just think about it for a second, it sort of fits a little bit. Terrorism, you know, if you have a separatist, is that the right way to say it?
Yeah.
Separatist faction, you know,
like the Basques or something.
Yeah, exactly. And they go and bomb something. Or the Corsicans, you know, fundamentalists. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I'm not sure we call them terrorists, do we? I'm not even sure.
No, certainly in France they don't.
It fits into a certain idea. Terrorism is when you hijack a plane or, I don't know. I feel that there is somewhat of a justification behind that change of narrative.
Well,
maybe I'm wrong.
Here's what the standard that I kind of threw out to people was in our newsroom was, if the same act was done by a man born in Egypt who immigrated to Norway and committed the same act, would you use the same language to define what he did? And everybody said no. Yeah. Everybody said at that point it becomes a terrorist act. And that's where I said that's the hypocrisy.
Turkey, how did Saudi Arabia, and maybe if you know what the Arab world in general receive that horrible news. You sort of hinted at, you know, in jest earlier in the show that he's not an Arab. Was that the way people received it?
Yeah, because the initial media was saying, and since most Arabic media reports using Reuters or AP, Associated Press, and so on, they would cover whatever they say, and they used the analysis suspected that he's a Muslim. Mm. And it was a huge relief when everybody finally saw who it was. While when I'm saying huge relief, it's not that they were happy that
of course.
It's just that finally nobody's going to accuse them of it. It's just a circle that's been killing everybody, that every terrorist act is officially automatically a Muslim terrorist or an Arab terrorist or something like that. And I think, have you seen the Daily Show, Jon Stewart, comment on it about Fox News?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this one is hilarious. He was O'Reilly. He's looking at him. And this guy is coming out and defending and saying, we should not blame Christianity for this. This guy does not represent Christians. He's not a Christian because he did not go to a church or anything like that. And then he brings another clip where about the terrorist attack in the army a year ago, I think, or something, where a soldier killed some people in the U.S. And then he brings in, he says, yeah, this is a representative, and how it's a huge terrorist religion, and they tell him, what's the proof? He doesn't go to the mosque. He calls himself soldier of Allah, so he represents Islam.
Yeah.
So well, it's like communism used to mean Russians, even though there are plenty of non-Russian communists. It's a shortcut. Terrorism has been – we started using terrorism as a shortcut. My question is, and I absolutely agree with you guys, that it was wrong to jump to the conclusion that this guy's a terrorist when you think he's Islamic and then change your mind when he's not. But have we found if he was acting as part of an organization? Because to me – I think he may just be a madman, not actually part of a terrorist organization of any kind. And that does, there is some accuracy involved in determining whether he's actually a terrorist or not.
What the latest is that he, as we've heard from the Norwegian government, is that he in fact is a lone psychopath. And that he's made allegations that he's got other cells around town. They've looked into it. They have yet to find any proof that he's got any other cells around Oslo and whatnot. So it's looking more and more like this guy was a sociopath from a very disturbed, broken family, had a very harsh upbringing, and had these kind of delusions of grandeur that oftentimes exist on extremes, both on the far left and the far right.
Tom, how did it...
Also, we have to look at the word terrorism. Where does it come from? It comes from the word terror. Terror, which does not have anything to do with an organization. It's about someone who goes and deliberately does something to frighten people and make their life scary. And that's exactly what he did. That's his target.
Are serial killers terrorists?
No, because they don't go and looking to scare people. They go because they enjoy the killing itself. It's not, they don't have an concept.
Well, but, okay, so I get your point, Turkey, but Lulzek terrorists? I mean, they're scaring people.
Yeah, but so I think that the idea, to an extent, Anonymous could be described as, you know, civil disobedience, which is not far from terrorism if you ask certain people. But terrorism, I think, implies more than just scaring people. It implies that you have a political agenda to push, and the way that you're going to try and impose it is by, you know, killing and terrorizing.
Well, he has a political agenda, and his agenda was
to
let his opinion, his views come out in public, and suddenly he got the attention he wanted. He specifically did that because he wanted attention for his manifesto.
And in that case, a serial killer is usually not a terrorist because they don't have an agenda other than, and in some cases, definitely frightening people. The astrological killer in the Zodiac killer in San Francisco had an agenda of frightening people. He didn't really have a political agenda. On the other hand, the Unabomber fits the definition of a terrorist because he did have a message and a political agenda.
Yeah, the Unabomber, in my opinion, is a terrorist.
Yes and no, because we're sort of, splitting hairs here, but it's important to to attribute that word of terrorism, which is in question. He wanted to, in his deranged mind, he wanted to do something that would shock the opinion so that his message would be received. But he's not saying, I will kill people and keep killing people until I get what I want. And I think terrorism is that.
But he does not want to do it because he knows he's going to end up in jail. He got his message out. But he is calling for others to do his job for him. If you read his entire manifesto, you'll find that's what he's calling for, war.
So in that case, I would have to say,
killing and keep on doing that. So
then I think he does fit the definition.
As Eric just said, we just have the concept. Let's say this is one Arab guy or one Muslim who has not connections to any other religious authority, who's just pissed off and decides to go and do it. Would the media still call him terrorist or not?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. There's no doubt.
What's been
Go ahead, Eric.
No, what's been so interesting this week is to hear the Norwegian Prime Minister coming out and really making what I'm interpreting as very subtle digs at the United States and how the U.S. changed.
Oh, it wasn't subtle at all. It was very clear.
I'm being a little bit polite here, but kind of how the United States, effectively lost its mind after 9/11 and upset so many of our constitutional protections. We gutted the Fourth Amendment on search and seizure in many respects, and they've said we're not going to change our way of life. We're not going to, go into this hyper mode, anti-terrorism mode, and the war on terror is not coming to Oslo. And I thought that was a very interesting reaction and kind of a subtle criticism.
And the only solution is more democracy.
And the only solution is more democracy. And it's not to go into a closed society, into a society of fear.
That is easier to say when you are dealing with a confirmed solo madman than an entire organization. It's still the right thing to do.
Fair enough. But bear in mind, the Norwegians are involved in the Libya operation. They have troops on the ground in Afghanistan. They are very much engaged in global operations, involving the Muslim world.
And also,
if you actually do talk to people who live in Norway or people who live in any of the countries up there, in Finland or Sweden or so on, they have a lot of people who are like that guy, and they are now worried like crazy about these people. Because they exist there. There's a lot of them. It's not that he's one of 10 or 20. They might be a minority, but there are big minority who live between all of these people.
Yeah, I don't think everyone is going to get up all of a sudden and start, killing hundreds of people. But I get your point, Turkey. I agree. Tom, we didn't really talk about how the U.S. received this news. I'm sure you have other fish to fry with the issue of the ceiling of the debt, but certainly it didn't go unnoticed.
I hate it when you ask me these questions, Patrick, because where I get my news is BBC, The Economist. I don't watch television news.
No, but you go to work, you talk to your friends,
Based on that, it was a minor blip on the radar. I did not hear people discussing it. I was actually down in San Diego. We were covering Comic-Con. I saw it on the front page of the Wall Street Journal in the hotel lobby, picked it up, and that's actually where I did first read about it, just the facts of what happened on that first day, and I didn't hear anyone discussing it.
That's interesting because to us, I mean, Eric was mentioning the fact that the Prime Minister didn't, specifically said we're not going to change our way of life, and that was part of the way we discussed it in the days after the event, and it was a very clear message about not about the United States, but I thought that maybe the U.S. would have picked up on that, and
I'm sure in certain quarters it absolutely was picked up on.
No, but it always tells me something about the way it's things are discussed in the U.S. when you don't really hear about them or hear specific details, because you're one of the more informed people and one of the more interested people in international affairs. So I guess that
doesn't mean my friends are.
Yeah. But trust me, had there been a cute blonde woman from Kansas who was shot and killed in that, you know, the incident, then you would have had it wall-to-wall coverage. But it's very, very difficult for a pure international story that's unrelated to anything American to break into the American news narrative, especially when you've got a story like the debt ceiling, which is just kind of sucking all the oxygen out of the room.
Well, and that is something that I did hear people not really discussing, but joking about. You know, at least it was a topic that was kicked around. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that, because actually, in France, at least, I'm guessing quite, you know, everywhere around the world, that's been a very discussed, very much discussed topic. And the issue of the of the debt in itself, as well of the issue of the you know, the two parties not being able to meet and compromise. I guess in France it's discussed in two ways. As I was saying, the issue of the debt itself, and if the U.S. don't manage to find a compromise and raise the ceiling, the consequences for the U.S. and the consequences for the rest of the world, because it would, you know, bring higher... Oh, Eric is making noises.
No, I hope I'm not.
A little bit. And it would bring, you know, higher... God, I'm losing the words.
Tax. What happens when you get engaged?
We're definitely going to be screwed if that happens.
Yeah, exactly. Let's sum it up.
We're pegged to the dollar. Exactly. Dollar goes down, we go down with it.
So that is one of the ways we're discussing it. And the other one is sort of trying to present it as objectively as possible and trying to show that Obama is... in a bit of a political move, but also as the president, trying to rise above and tell everyone, okay, children, now sit down and agree on something. And also, it seems to me, and again, a lot of people say that often, but it seems to me that the Republicans are the ones who are sort of blocking the situation. And it might be because, as I'm saying, I'm in more of a liberal left-wing environment. So,
well, it depends. It depends. They both are blocking it, but each is blocking it for a different reason.
Well, yeah, that's the kind of thing I'm sort of asking about to our two U.S. representatives. Is that an accurate, a fair description, or is it actually just as bad as for one side as the other? And talking to Tom, you have an incredibly annoying way of being objective about things, and you try to present things as factual as possible all the time, to the point that I'm like, come on, put
that's
a little bit
so
of...
so annoying.
Yeah, it's so... So
I apologize.
I'm guessing whatever you say, I think I'm gonna trust. But yeah, whoever wants to go first. No one.
Wait, what?
Tom, you go.
Okay. Yeah, well, I do think that the Republicans are probably getting tarred a little more as being the party that's blocking, simply because they control the majority in the House. And so it's seen as they could push something through if they wanted to, but they're sort of dragging their heels. But at the same time, the Democrats aren't compromising as much as they would like to. As the Republicans would like to. So the general sense in the United States is not to point fingers at one party or another, but to say they're all a bunch of idiots. Why are they doing this? It's a political football. They could work it out this second if they really wanted to. They're trying to gain points and make the other side look irresponsible. The Democrats
really?
Are trying
is
to make
it?
The that's the mood, is that the Democrats are trying to make the Republicans look like they'll drag the country down for their ideology, and the Republicans are trying to make the Democrats look the same, like they'll drag the country down for their ideology. The Republicans' ideology is, of course, reducing spending but not increasing any revenues, and the Democrats is the opposite. And the president actually, I think, is coming off a little better than I expected in this, in the attempt to rise above. And I don't think either party is really getting the political points that they want to get in the upcoming election. And the reason we don't have an agreement on this is because of that there is an election coming up next year.
Is it completely there's a certainty that this is just political game? There's no way that they could this is actually people standing up for their ideals?
No. Well, the fact that John Boehner had to delay the vote because of Tea Party members shows that there is a little bit of ideological guts going on, where people are sort of inflexibly sticking to their ideology against the good of the country. I mean, no one really disagrees that the ceiling has to be raised. It's just it's a fact of life, and you can blame whoever you want. The Republicans are trying to make it look like the Democrats have been irresponsible, and we shouldn't encourage it by raising the ceiling. But then you send the country into default to punish the Democrats. It doesn't make any sense. So what they want to do is force a point and make the Democrats reduce that spending finally. And the fact of the matter is that's not going to happen. The Republicans won't even let it happen. They won't want that amount of spending to come down and balance the budget this time. It's just not possible. So it's all about principle. It's all about making your point. And I think they will come to an agreement. Everybody thinks they will come to agreement. Mm. But because of those ideological people that are unwilling to compromise within their own party, there's a chance that it might not get done.
Eric, before I move the ball to you, oh, crap. I lost my point. Okay, you go, Eric.
Well, there are a couple big disconnects that are happening here. First of all, the national polling is all saying that people want to compromise. If you look at all the major polls that have come out in the past 2 weeks, the problem is that representatives both in the Senate and the House don't work for national constituencies. They have local constituencies. Their local polling is oftentimes far more extreme. In part, that's because, unlike here in France, unlike in Europe, where the districts that members of parliament represent are not defined purely on politics. In the United States, they've been what they call gerrymandered. So what you end up having is you have these districts that are extremely conservative in many respects, and also just very, very partisan. So those politicians are responding to those local districts. Secondly, the biggest issue here is the fact that fundamentally Americans want a government that they can't afford and they're not willing to pay for. That is the biggest disconnect. So you'll hear people talk about, we want to control the debt, we want to control spending, but you can't touch the military, you can't touch Social Security, and you can't touch Medicare. Well, that's about 75% of all the budget right there is entitlements. So that's the biggest disconnect. The problem is, though, and this is what's not being included in the U.S. debate at all, is the implications overseas. The Chinese have been sending very, very clear messages as owners of $1.16 trillion of our debt, that they're going to be really pissed off if this goes south. Now, already on Tuesday, we're expecting Moody's and Standard & Poor's to take us down from a AAA to a AA. And the consequence of that is now all of a sudden, the debt just got more expensive to finance. And so my 2-year-old son, who's going to be an American taxpayer one day, is going to be paying into this debt even more because now the interest rates are going to go up as of next Tuesday.
Yeah, it's already happened basically. The screwing up of the country. Yeah, sorry. I mean, the downgrade hasn't come yet, but already, and that's a feeling that we have in France, the trust in the US, the financial trust, has been degraded and has been, you know, hurt by this circus that's being played.
Let me give you an example of this. Last week, Hillary Clinton was out at the ASEAN summit. And imagine, you know, Hillary has been the embodiment of what's called the Washington consensus, which is the IMF-backed kind of view of the world of, you know, having very, very, you know, conservative types of governments, austerity measures that are very tough to swallow for the Greeks, which I know we're going to talk about later on. So she goes all over the world saying, you guys have to get your act together. And that's the Washington consensus. Well, now what's happening is that you're starting to hear from governments going, what are you have no right to preach to us. Look at the mess you guys have. Now, Hillary says, that's just democracy and it's messy and that's just the way we have it. The fact of the matter is that the legitimacy of the United States on economic matters is starting to mirror now the legitimacy of the United States on security and political matters, which is falling precipitously. Americans, for the most part, have no clue about the low regard with which they're held around the world.
I disagree with that. I think they have a clue. I think they don't care. Sort of like whenever that comes up, usually the thing is like, well, what do we care what the rest of the world thinks of us? We're going to do what's right.
Yeah, Yeah, no, I agree. It's definitely a little bit of both. We just saw a poll this week come out of Cairo that in Egypt, you know, approval of the United States went from a historic low of 30% now down to 5%. That has real consequences on the ground when you're trying to implement policy. And when you're trying to actually get things done, and when you're trying to actually build coalitions in order to have favorable trade agreements, favorable security arrangements, all of that matters. So that nativist reaction that, Tom, you mentioned is absolutely true. Most people say, I don't care what the rest of the world thinks, but they have no idea what the consequences of what that means. And that means that the United States is no longer going to be the superpower that it has the influence that it's had for the past 50 years.
You know, to an extent, even on my very very modest level, one of the reactions I found myself having this morning when I woke up, I was thinking about this, and you guys know I love the U.S. I go there, you know, several times a year. The best of my friends are in the U.S. I don't need to make a case, you know, for the fact that I love the U.S. But what I thought was, I heard these people chanting, "We're number one. We're number one." And seeing that thing happening, it was like, you're number one in what? Sure, there are some things that you guys do extremely well, but look at yourselves, you know?
Self-confidence. Americans are number one in self-confidence.
I guess, which is good. But, yeah, it's and the country is made up of its people. And it's not true that – I think there is a feeling of – these guys in Washington, and Jeff Jarvis has that whole, you know, campaign started about fuck Washington with the hashtag and all that. And yes, I'm sure it is the politicians who are doing this, but the political world is made up of the fabric of the country. And in France, we have, you know, people who think they can get, you know, who get away with cheating the authorities a little bit with not paying this tax or not doing that. And it shows, you know, that we have a certain kind of political people of political, personalities. And they do, you know, you have a scandal every now and then. They do try to get away with this and that. And we let it go. So what I'm trying to say is, it's not just that Washington is one way. It is a reflection of some measure of what the country is.
And I think that's what Eric was pointing out when he talked about the gerrymandering is, if you look at the national polls, the United States is actually fairly moderate and fairly reasonable on the whole, with some exceptions. But on the whole, they want what is certainly reasonable, but the extremes are in charge. And that's perfectly true in the state of California where I live, and it's reflected on the national scale as well, because politicians have been so good at gaming the system over the past several decades to put their own people in charge that now a moderate has a much harder job of winning a congressional seat. Moderates are only good at winning presidential seats, and even then, they have to be a little extreme in the primaries to get to that final election.
Yeah. And talking about extremes, when you're saying that there is some ideological aspect to this fight, which I'm sure there is, one thing that comes to mind is the fact that the spending was raised a lot more under the Bush administration than under the Obama administration. So I'm sort of...
Patrick, let me just kind of... This is you're saying there's some ideological. This is purely ideological. This is a political fight. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, came out and said this is about making sure Obama does not have a second term. The Republicans are not subtle about this. This is all about... Now, here's the thing. You said that, you know, there was some idea of who's going to kind of get the blame. Will the Republicans get the blame? At the end of the day, the president is accountable for the performance of the economy in good times and bad. Clinton benefited from this huge boom, and he won a second term on that. The downgrade on Tuesday will be fodder for the Republican political ads. And the political ads next year are going to say, who was overseeing our economy when we got downgraded? No one's going to care why. Okay. So at the end of the day, this is what it's about. It's making sure Obama does not have a second term.
So this makes it sound like the Republicans are sort of blocking it.
It's a system in Washington that is built on extremes, as Tom said. And, Obama has desperately tried to be in the middle, which is not effective. John Stewart this week was saying, he gets on national television to appeal to people to call his congressman because he's saying, I can't do anything. You do something, appealing to people to do it. Because at the end of the day, it's looking more and more that Obama's impotent in this fight. He can't, and Boehner as well is impotent because of his extremes are pulling him in the different direction.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have a default on Tuesday. It's not really a default. It's going to be just not being able to pay our bills because truly we are going to pay our bondholders, which is the ultimate definition of a default. And so we are going to pay the bondholders on Tuesday.
Turkey, you're being very silent.
There's not much I can say about it. I think they covered most of it.
Yeah, they did. But I'd be really curious to hear about, the view on... Because obviously, Saudi Arabia is a very... strong partner of the U.S. And even though, sometimes when we're having difficulties related to, energy and oil and things like that, you're half laughing because you're like, yeah, buy more oil. In this case, we're having difficulty, and I'm sure the Saudis are very concerned also, as you were saying, about the consequences in the world economy is that
Saudi is going to be really hurt really bad if the dollar ever drops any lower, because that's what we're connected to. Everything here is going up in prices. The government is doing a lot of efforts trying to control the price hikes that are keeping happening every single day.
So you're already feeling the consequences of the...
Since the crisis, since the dollar has been starting falling. Oh, okay. And this is only increasing the pressure on the dollar, and it's increasing the pressure on us. So individuals here are hurting. Everybody is pissed off at what's going on. And while they're pissed off at the Americans, they're also pissed off at our authorities, like the central bank or the Ministry of Finance. There's a huge demand right now that we should be disconnect ourselves from the dollar and go independent or something, because this dollar is really killing everybody here. So this is really affecting everybody, and everybody's keeping track. And I think the people just do enjoy having a laugh also in Saudi and the Arab world. And you'll find that also most noticeable in Egypt. People like to make jokes whenever there's a crisis. And I think people are just enjoying the fact that Apple has more cash than the U.S. government at the moment. So I heard people talking about it all day today.
Really?
Wow. So that's the number one news today about the U.S. problem.
To conclude on that topic, how is the mood every day in the U.S., Tom? Is it like, because this is actually we're sort of talking seriously and then joking a little bit about it, but it's a very serious crisis. And I understand that most people probably think it's going to be resolved ultimately because they're going to find an agreement. But are people a little bit more somber? Are they concerned or...
Well, I mean, I always want to preface this stuff that I only know the mood of mostly course. Of the technology community in the Bay Area, not of the entire country. Although my sister was visiting from Illinois, so I got a little sense of what they're thinking about it. And most people shake their heads, blame the politicians, assume that there will be a deal worked out, and that things are already kind of so messed up that, it's what's to be expected, that nothing works these days, and it's going to take a while to pull out of it. But we've been through this before. I get a little sense of, this happened in the 90s, and this is, this is the theater of politics, and it's a shame and it's awful, and I hope the government doesn't go broke. But the last time the government shut down, the world didn't end, so we'll see what happens is kind of the mood. And it's mostly joking. It's mostly talking about the fact that, their government's going to go broke and Apple has more money than the United States government and things like that. That was a big topic here as well.
And, I guess the ultimate irony is this, in all this is that ultimately when they are going to find an agreement and to vote, the raising of the ceiling, it's still raising the freaking ceiling so that you can owe more money to other people. And the situation is still absolutely terrible. So it's, I don't know, I guess we're sort of all going to be happy that the Washington managed to get their act together and find an agreement, but it's not a happy thing they're doing. You know, it's not like we're raising the ceiling, everything is going to be fine. It's quite the opposite, actually. It's just a lesser of two evils. Of two evils, I guess. But
generally, when the economy is good, governments, lower their debts and start to move more towards balanced budgets. And when the economy is bad, they have to spend themselves into debt. That's true on city levels, county levels, state levels, and country levels. And that's no different. So, you know, there's certainly an argument to be had about whether we've spent more than we actually needed to. But I don't think any economist would legitimately say that the government should not have been spending to get themselves out of the recession. It's just a matter of what level it should have been spending.
Sure, sure. Well, talking about getting ourselves out of recessions and other unpleasant situations, that's a perfect transition to talk about Greece and even Spain, which have been making the rounds in Europe, at least in France, in the past few weeks, because yet again, Greece is in deep trouble, and Spain is even calling early elections because they're not sure about their situation, and they want to strengthen the political climate a little bit early to make sure they can handle their economic situation. Eric, maybe you can describe things a little bit better than I would.
Well, the only solace that Americans should have is that Europe is more screwed in many ways than the U.S. is. In fact, that's been the saving grace of the U.S. because had Europe been strong, all of this money would have been fleeing out of U.S. debt and into European debt, which unfortunately is worthless right now, in part because of these southern peripheral countries, you know, Portugal, Italy, and, well, Ireland is up in there too, but Greece and Spain. The big story of the past week or 2 weeks was actually not Greece, it was Italy. I don't know if you recall that bond traders started dumping the Italian debt, and that really scared the crap out of everyone, because all of a sudden you're moving into now to continental Europe, and it highlights the exposure that a lot of that on the continent. It's not just now, you know, these, you know, what the perception of these lazy Greek workers and the, you know, who just want to sit in the sunshine and eat their olives and then collect, you know, retirement at 50 years old. It's
that's
now
what I want to do.
That's what we, but, you know, again, that's a German myth. The truth is that if you look at the OECD statistics, they all come out saying that the Greeks actually work more hours than the French and the Germans. They work longer days.
But we work better.
Yes. And, you know, especially in August here in France, when, you know, everybody's working very hard. But you really have a situation where we're sitting at the, on the edge of a cliff right now in Europe. Yeah. And frankly, you know, Americans aren't paying attention to this, but this is something they should be paying attention to, because if Europe goes down, it's going to bring everybody with it. Bringing back the conversation to the Chinese, what we've talked about earlier, is it's been the Chinese that have been keeping the euro stable by, you know, purchasing huge volumes of the currency. In part, they want to get away from their dependence on the U.S., and they're shifting a lot of these investments into the euro, and that's been a blessing for Europeans. Again, people here aren't even aware of that.
So this is the moment in the show where I eat a big chunk of that humble pie after my rant about the U.S., where apparently it's not all that much better for us.
It's disastrous here. I mean, yeah. There's no way to sugarcoat it. And French banks in particular, you know, lent money like, you know, those mortgage dealers in the U.S. did. And they just like drunken sailors. They were giving money out to the pig economies, the French and German banks. So they're partially responsible for all of this.
So basically what we should all do is start to go and buy canned goods and chocolate.
I will say it was impressive to see Italy respond much more nimbly than the United States has responded. And granted, it was a more severe crisis. But Italian politics is known for being very theatrical as well. And they stepped up to the plate in a way that the United States has yet to do.
Well, they can have a much more adult conversation here in politics. You can have a conversation about the need to cut spending and raise taxes. That's a conversation that cannot happen in the United States in the current political climate. So in the UK, they're cutting spending and they're raising taxes. In Italy, same thing. And you just can't have that. And there's not this innate objection to paying taxes, in part because people here really enjoy the public services that they get. We have great health care. We have free education. We have great public transportation. You do feel like you get what you pay for here, and there's not that sense in the United States. So when politicians come to us and say, we need you to pay more taxes, people don't really resist that much.
I mean, we do resist a little bit, but...
In nowhere near American levels.
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely a sense of... Even in the case of Greece, I mean, you have a few people who will say... Well, we don't need these kinds of countries in the EU then. You know, they we don't want to pay for them. You have a few people and maybe a few journalists who will put forth that argument. But overall, I think there is a sense of we're all in this together. And sure, the Greeks and, you know, all these other countries will have to be to make sacrifices, and when people go out in the streets and don't want to make these sacrifices in these countries, we're a little bit annoyed because we're paying through the nose for them. But overall, there's a sentiment of we're in this together, and things work out for whatever issues that we have. Life is still working out pretty well. We have, as Eric is saying, you know, free education, free healthcare. And when we look at other places, maybe, you know, the third world countries and, you know, to an extent, the U.S. with the issues of public health care, we're willing to sacrifice quite a bit of our money in order to have peace of mind and these kinds of safety nets. So maybe this is a reason why I don't find it as catastrophic as you're implying, Eric. Maybe it's because I have these, again, we were talking about rose-colored glasses earlier. Maybe I have this symptom of rose-colored glasses in that case, too. I'm like, you know, it's dangerous, but ultimately it's going to work out.
I mean, I'm not a big fan of Sarkozy here in France, but on some of his numbers, I agree with him that you look at the amount of money going out to support the social benefits here in Europe and in France and the amount of money coming in, and they just don't add up. And, you know,
we'll just raise the ceiling debt.
But you've got, you know, 25% and 30% unemployment among youth here. I mean, yeah. It's tragic. And so there, but again, a lot of people, and this is the problem in Paris, is that a lot of people who live in the city of Paris don't realize what's happening in the suburbs and in the rest of the country.
That's true.
And that's a New York problem, and it's an LA problem as well. You know, there's a disconnect between the heartland and the cities.
Canned goods, people. Canned
goods.
You mean real France?
Yeah.
We're from real France.
America.
Turkey. Thoughts about?
I'm enjoying you people talking about taxes.
Cute and quaint.
Yeah, it's nice not to be paying any taxes. Just sit here and just listen to the poor people who pay taxes.
It's all of our money going to pay for your public services through our gas tags. That's the way it is, you know.
Yeah, sure. You pay your money, huh? At least I'm not paying it.
So, has that even been a blip on the radar, as someone was saying earlier, like Greece and, you know, Italy and Spain and Ireland?
No, it's been a lot more quieter. There's been a little talk. It's been in the news a little, but nothing major. I think there's too much more stuff for the Arab world to keep their eye on than. Looking at Greece or anything, you got all the problems in Syria, you got Libya, you got the financial problems within each country. In Saudi Arabia, they have their own problems. Every other Arab country has its own problems. So I think the U.S. Crisis is the one that everybody is keeping an eye on, because that's what really affects at least the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia specifically. So.
Yeah, I guess one of the reasons why I have a little bit of a more... It's not like I'm at ease, but I feel like people like in Europe, the political leadership in Europe on the EU level is taking things seriously and doing what needs to be done. You know,
there's a much better conversation going on here. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to something else again. Before we go into... actually, we could talk about Libya and Syria and Egypt, and there are important things happening there too, but I'd much rather talk about the issues in the Horn of Africa at the moment, which have been discussed very heavily in the past, I would say, 2 or 3 weeks, with a terrible drought happening there. And obviously, people... refugees having to flee the regions where they live and going into camps where they can't they don't have enough. It's not even about money. This drought is affecting so many people that there are no resources to help them. And
why are you spending the Western propaganda, Patrick?
I'm not sure, but I will be very happy to hear your propaganda instead of mine.
No, that's not my propaganda. The Islamic Youth Movement, which is controlling Somalia, have been going out in public and claiming there's nothing wrong and this is all Western propaganda and everything is fine in their country.
Oh, in that sense. You know, that's interesting. I haven't really heard that... that aspect of it. Certainly, we know that the Islamic groups controlling what is it? What's the name of the region in Somalia?
Mogadishu, mostly south of.
It's mostly
Somalia.
Yeah.
So we know that they are
in the south and so on. So
they're refusing to let the humanitarian organizations in with help, which I think it was on France 24, actually, which I heard about the fact that some of these militias are afraid that European operatives would sneak in with the humanitarian aid organizations.
Yeah, I mean, if only we cared enough. I mean, that's really the highlight of the story is the fact that, you know, for about 10 million Somalis, you know, their lives are going to end because, you know, they're governed and ruled by people who are just, you know, assholes to start with. And then at the end of the day, you know, the Americans and no Western government's going to intervene. We, you know, we have Hollywood movies now that are made about Black Hawk Down from the last time we did that. And at the end of the day, most Americans and Europeans simply don't care. They feel like they've seen this story before. They gave a lot of money. You know, Bono's come back out again and trying to kind of get Band-Aid going again. You know, they're getting the band back together, no pun intended, but truly trying to get the band back together to raise money for Somalia and East Africa, and nobody cares. You know, we have the largest French language, you know, Facebook news page in the world, and we posted up a poll saying, is this an important story for you, and is this an important issue for you? And you'd be shocked at how few people actually said yes.
Well, tell us.
I don't have the specific numbers, but it was a clear majority that said the debt crisis in Europe, the immigration in Europe, the debt crisis in the U.S. You know, you've got big political stories that are going on right now that are far more important. People are just like, yeah, there's starvation in Africa. We've heard that before. So and the fact that the warlords themselves are partially responsible for not allowing the food to get in makes this, you know, this is a man-made story in many respects. The drought certainly isn't man-made, but at the end of the day, the ability to deliver the aid is a man-made story, and the sympathy goes down a lot for that.
Oh, go ahead, Turkey.
It's been also big news here. It's been covered heavily. Actually, there's a huge movement to collect donations and send money to Somalia for the. I think the king donated about 60 million riyals as his part of the effort.
Is there a feeling that, I mean, maybe, you know, I'll ask you guys. Do you feel like it's your responsibility to help? Do you have a responsibility to help personally? And when I say personally, I say maybe as a part of your country's government and actions.
Yeah, I believe that my government should be doing something to help solve the problem in concert with the rest of the United Nations. This is exactly the kind of thing that the United Nations could be good at, but isn't good at.
And are they not?
The fact of the matter is, Somalia is not a nation state. And that is a huge problem for people to wrap their heads around. They're like, well, why doesn't Somalia get their act together? Why doesn't someone come in and get rid of the rebels? There aren't any rebels. There's no central government. This is a medieval like situation. This is an ancient situation. You don't have a power structure. You don't have a modern situation of government here. And it's going to take a lot more than we have ever done to get that problem solved. This isn't just, oh, we got to go in and remove a dictator or prop up a state or call for free elections. You have to re-engineer, in my opinion, hundreds of years of civilization back into this region.
Eric, Turkey?
I mean, the United Nations is not good at it. Our best, you know, we impose our ideals on the United Nations and we wish they were good at it. They're really not. And they're not good at dealing with these nimble situations. The World Food Program has struggled to deliver the aid. They'll tell you through their own propaganda that it's not their fault. But at the end of the day, they're only as good as their member countries want them to be, and there just isn't a lot of interest in this right now. The other part of this is that contributions to the World Food Program and to the United Nations and to aid programs as a whole are being cut. DFID, which is the British aid program, is being slashed across the European Union. They're cutting. So they're just, and you know, in the United States, you know, we're the stingiest country of the developed world. We give 1/1000th of our GNP to foreign aid. But yet, if you ask Americans what they should cut first, they say foreign aid. And they think that we give, you know, 10-15% of our budget to it. So there's, again, we've been talking about disconnects this this show, and there's a disconnect there too. So without that alignment, it's going to be very hard to do anything effective.
Turkey?
Well, I'm going to be the evil guy in this situation. I think we should take care of our own people first. When we solve our own problems, then we can spend all the money we want on others. I think all money should be spent on your own people before you start spending it on others. If an individual donates, that's another situation. You're donating and you're helping, then that's your right. But for the government to go and spend the people's money on other people is just not the way to do it.
That's a
Turkey is a good American.
Yeah, he's a good American, and it's a very potentially very short-sighted way of looking at things, because if you ignore these people, they can quickly become your problem. And that's what we learned in Afghanistan. And I think if that mentality was in place after World War II, which, you know, there was a nativist streak in the United States for a long time. We have a long isolationist history of saying, you know what, let the Europeans, it's not anything to do with us. It helps us more than it helps them, in part because by rebuilding Europe, we were able to sell and we were able to profit more. So while that's what you're saying, Turkey, is absolutely right, and that's what most people around the world think, it could potentially be very short-sighted.
But there is,
I think it's enough that there's individuals who are donating. The charities here are collecting a lot of money right now just from individuals. Why should when we have people who are poor, people who are dying of hunger, or people who are below the poor rate and so on, why should we go and give other people, let's solve our problems before we turn to helping others?
Well, I guess there is a bigger question here. How do you actually go out and solve it? Because sure, we can go and send food, but that's not going to be enough because it's being blocked. But then do you actually send troops to help distribute the food and reorganize the country? Well, then you're going to have people who say you shouldn't intervene and you should let the people come to democracy by themselves. What is okay? Maybe that's not the case in these countries, but is the way China is doing it the right one? Should we massively invest in these countries and make them, you know, basically our factories?
Making it our factories is an oversimplification of it.
Sure, yeah.
You know, what we do know is that the West has spent $1 trillion in Africa in the past 25 to 30 years to very little effect, that most of the indicators of human health have not gone up. So we know that, you know, just pumping in lots of money doesn't solve the problem. In Somalia, there's you can divide the crisis into two parts. One is this humanitarian crisis that's present right now, which is just to stop the hunger. And then there's another set, which is building, as Tom pointed out, to actually a country. We don't have any type of institutions or any type of governance. That's a destabilizing force for all of East Africa. And that's a problem. Now, going back to, you know, depending on individuals to give money, the problem with that is that individuals will give money for lots of different reasons, but oftentimes it's not for the most important reasons. Malaria is one of the biggest killers in the world. It's not a sexy topic. It's not like breast cancer or AIDS or any of these others. Very difficult to raise money for simple $50 nets. Individuals don't give money to those types of things. So what kills more people and destabilizes societies and ultimately upsets the balance of power in many parts of the world can be something very, very simple that individuals by themselves can't solve.
All right. I guess we could talk, as I often say, a lot more about this, but we shall now move on to maybe local stories. I don't know if you guys have more local stories that you want to discuss. We sort of addressed a little bit of the U.S. here. Do you guys have something you want to talk about before we wrap the show up? Turkey, I actually would be interested in hearing about this driving issue, women driving issue, which we mentioned a few times, but it might have evolved. Yeah, go ahead.
It's dead.
It's dead. So
it's dead. Yeah.
Really? So yeah. Women are not going to get the right to drive, and that's finished. The discussion is over?
And the whole discussion has almost gone very, very dead. So it's there's still discussion, but it's not as it was as a huge movement. It's people have forgot, most people forgot or ignoring and so on. I told you that this would have been this problem as soon as they turned for international help. That killed the entire attitude toward this movement. So when Hillary Clinton supported, when Congress started interfering and demanding, and all of these people and demonstrations, that's really hurt the entire movement, and it's officially now mostly dead. So
because it was seen as the foreigners are telling us what to do, just shut the hell up, we don't want to hear about it.
Exactly. Okay. So that's the situation right now. Other than that, I think the only other local news right now is the biggest news is Ramadan.
I'm sorry? Oh, no, Ramadan. Okay.
Ramadan is on Monday, after tomorrow.
And so you're going to start not eating forever now?
Yep. From sunrise till sunset. No food, no water.
So this is possibly the worst time to have Ramadan. It's the longest days.
Yeah, but it's not that big of a deal as the longest day in Saudi. It's more about the heat.
Yeah. So do you have people who, I'm just very curious, do you have people who cheat? Like who?
Definitely. Everywhere. There's people who cheat everywhere.
Okay. So it's not uncommon to have a guy, you know, sneak out to have a drink of water or something. But yeah. They don't do it in public, right?
Unless they want to be arrested.
Okay.
Drinking or eating in public or smoking is completely forbidden during Ramadan, during daytime.
Ooh, smoking also?
Yes.
Wow.
So no smoking, no drinking, no eating, as long as the sun is out.
Okay. And so, of course,
by jail, anybody, and all restaurants are closed until about sunset.
So you, of course, never cheat. You're talking about other people.
No, I enjoy it, actually. I think it's in a way, it helps you to clear your body out of all the bad stuff you have. It's really healthy if you do it right.
But then you eat all the crap at night.
No, that's why I emphasize if you do it right.
Ah.
I emphasize that word.
You mean that you only eat healthy stuff at night too?
Yeah, you don't overeat. That's the problem. Many people gain weight during Ramadan instead of losing because they go hungry all day and suddenly they eat all of this crap like what they would have eaten in 2 days, they will eat it in one night.
I'm hungry now.
Yeah, so that's one thing. Ramadan is also, there's a lot of people who don't understand that when they're not fasting, they're supposed to drink a lot of liquids, a lot of water, to help their kidneys to work after being dry all day, and some people don't do that, and that's really also makes it a problem. So if you do it all, if you do this entire system right, it's the hunger, it doesn't really bother you that much, and you should be okay with it, and it really helps you, you mentally and physically.
Okay, sounds good. I won't do it, but sure, why not? Tom, is there anything like super lighthearted and cool coming out of the U.S., maybe of California, or are you going to tell us about a horrible story?
Well, the biggest news in the U.S. generally was the end of the NFL lockout for the National Football League. So there will be football.
What is that?
The owners and the players had a dispute over collective bargaining. It's really the only labor issues that get covered in the United States is when sports, when athletes go on strike or get locked out by the owners. So that was actually dominating the headlines more than the debt crisis, to be honest.
Really?
And people are enthusiastic now that we will have American football in the fall. So that's more people talking about that than anything. There was also Carmageddon down in L.A. I don't know if you heard about that.
I heard about that on Tech News Today, yes. But
they shut down ahead. One of the main freeways, the 405, and there was all of this hype beforehand and government outreach telling people to stay off the highways, and it was going to be horrible because they wouldn't be able to be on the highway, so it was going to crowd all the arteries that go from one end of L.A. to another. It turned out nobody drove. It was all the people I know in LA that I've talked to, like, it was the best weekend ever. If you actually did have to go somewhere, there was no traffic.
Tom, you'll love this. In Europe, they said the closure of the 405 freeway in Los Angeles. That's what the Europeans were referring to it.
Well, at least they used the, which is an LA, you know.
They did, but the 405 freeway was closed.
The 405th freeway. It sounds like an infantry group. But, you know, and the one local story that I'm actually interested in here in the Bay Area, well, actually a California story, there was a commission established by the voters to independently create the legislative district. So this goes back to what we were talking to earlier about the gerrymandering. This independent panel has several Democrats, several Republicans, several independents. It's 14 members, and it's supposed to come to a decision that has to have three of each type, three independents, three Republicans, and three Democrats agree on the map. So they've agreed. On Friday, they put out the new map with an independently created district. It's supposed to be, you know, based not on politics, you know, but on what is best for the state. And of course, immediately, as soon as it was put out, it was determined that it probably would end up benefiting the Democrats just because of the way it was created. It was going to benefit somebody no matter what they did. Mm-hmm. And so one of the Republicans voted against the state assembly redistricting. Two of the Republicans voted against the congressional U.S. representative redistricting, and Republicans are already talking about suing to prevent the map from being implemented.
Okay. Is this just business as usual? Or
oh, yeah.
Is
no,
there...
if this map had come out and benefited the Republicans, you would have had exactly the same reaction from the Democrats. It's sports for them. They don't care about actually helping the country. They care about winning.
No, what I was asking was, you know, we've had in history in general, in all countries, we have, you know, since World War II, we've had a pretty stable situation in North America and Europe, but it seems like the things are going gradually becoming a little bit worse. And I know that everyone always says, you know, it's getting worse, and years go by and things just keep working fine, and it's just the way it is. So in general, is this just the way it is, or are things actually getting problematic, and can in the U.S. can people not get in any kind of agreement to the point where at some point there's going to need to be a revolution? In Europe, are we wasting so much money? Are we living so much above our needs that at some point we're not going to be able to pay for what we want and just need to start from scratch and maybe need a war or a revolution to do a purge and start again, you know, from a more healthy foundation?
It's all cyclical, in my opinion. And if you only look back to World War II, you get a skewed view, especially in the United States, where we benefited greatly from having no war fought on our soil and the ability to help rebuild Europe and Japan and China and make a ton of money and get a lot of people moving here, a lot of brain drain. And that has expired now. You know, the United States is back to being on equal footing with the rest of the world. We're not the beneficiary of World War II anymore. But if you look, go back to the 1800s, we had much worse political problems and scandals in the United States. And if you, you know, you go back to the 1600s and 1700s, things were horrible in Europe. Not a single country trusted each other. The idea of a single currency in Europe would have been absolutely ridiculous and unimaginable.
Well, it would
have
been...
you know, overall, things are getting better, but they go in cycles. And will we need a revolution? Mm. You know, maybe, yeah. Will it be a glorious revolution, a bloodless revolution, or a bloody one? Hard to say. I like to think that we have progressed to the point where it would be a largely bloodless revolution that changes things, but... You know, that we may not have grown as a species out of that yet. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that was my point. You know, things were much worse in, you know, if you look back a couple of centuries, but you did have these cyclical purges every once in a while where basically you had to kill a certain percentage of the population through war or whatever. And World War II was just the last one of these huge crises that spawned a spark in the economy and spending and working that gave a healthy foundation for the world to build on, including on the political scene, because it really seems like I don't know, I'm just, you know, thinking.
Well, and our reaction to war was much different in the 50s than, you know, after just having been through one, than it is now, where, you know, war is very, very distant for most people. You know, not for everyone, obviously, but in the United States, it's something that other people generally go do on faraway lands, not something like World War II, where most people were affected by it.
Maybe we should just build giant robots, let them do the warring for us, put all our money in them, and then decide who wins and start from scratch from there.
Which is kind of what we're doing with all our drone programs, frankly.
And with all our economies going down the drain. It's sort of a way... Yeah, maybe not. All right.
Can't we just... Hold on.
Turkey?
I said, couldn't we just do it on Warcraft?
Ah, that would be an interesting idea. It wouldn't
be
very
expensive.
Well, the
Koreans would want it to be StarCraft, and then we'd already have that.
Patrick, let me just lighten up before we go, just lighten up the subject, because it's been gloom and doom for a lot of this conversation.
But it usually is, yes.
The tourism minister here in France, Frédéric Lebreuve, he is concerned right now. And, you know, Paris is the world's number one tourist destination of, you know, 70 million people come here. But he's concerned about the reputation of the Parisians as being, shall I say, rude. And so they've actually launched a whole new website and a marketing campaign to dispel the idea that the French and Parisians are rude. And it's called rendezvousenfrance.com. And it's trying to tell Americans and the rest of the world that Parisians aren't quite as mean and nasty as they're told to be. Not the Pepe Le Pew type of reputation is not deserved. And they're also trying to get people to kind of go into the countryside and see the rest of France. So rendezvousenfrance.com is the new initiative from the tourism minister here to kind of rebrand France Incorporated.
So they're trying to spread rumors and lies.
Basically, yes. I will admit, you know, maybe somewhat undermining the work of this this wonderful website. There's a lot of, let's say, less than stellar customer service in French businesses in general.
There is no customer service.
I mean, getting yelled at by a waiter in a bistro or a cafe is part of the experience. That's
it is
what you
part
get.
Of the experience.
Well, how dare you be so presumptuous to be a consumer?
Exactly. How dare you want to give me your money for something that I do for you?
So how's the Paris economy being affected with the ban on the burqa?
Oh, the burqa has no effect on it whatsoever, because it was really just cynical politics at the end of the day. That, you know, only 3,000 women in France actually wear the niqab. So
no, I'm talking about the tourism.
There's
a lot of tourists who wear niqab.
You know what they're doing is that you're seeing, you know, the Saudi women, they come onto Champs-Élysées and they go into Louis Vuitton and they, you know, they put on big sunglasses and they cover themselves up in other more subtle ways, but without having to wear a niqab. You know, those
London is benefiting from that ban also.
It might be. Awesome. But Louis Vuitton here has been opening after hours for the Saudis. So they've been going in after dark in, you know, for private shopping experiences. So there's other ways of, I'm sure the French will take your credit cards.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's always way for you to give us your money, even though, and in Louis Vuitton, I'm sure you get a above average customer service experience. You know, it's much better than it is in other.
And I hope so, for the amount we're paying them.
Yeah, that's the point. Eric, do you have anything, you know, to tell us about China? Because we never really get people from with knowledge of that region. How is China doing in this whole mood of doom and gloom that we were mentioning earlier?
No, they don't have a sense of doom and gloom the same way that's in the West. What the story to watch right now is this train crash story, and in part because it is really highlights the power of the Chinese web. And again, this is something that's difficult. You know, I listen to TNT every day, and I listen to Twit every week, and I listen to, you know, all the various podcasts, and there isn't this sense of awareness in the U.S. kind of tech media of just how truly huge the Chinese web has become. So the mobile, the microblogging has really had an amazing effect on this story. 4 minutes after the train crash.
Can you tell us about the story itself? Because I'm not sure everyone knows.
The story, sure. So last week, two high-speed trains, these part of China's brand new, they're building 12,000 miles of high-speed train. Now, in the context of where Tom is in California, we're trying to build, as Californians, a 600-mile and it's taking, you know, between Sacramento and San Diego, and it's taking, you know, 10, 15 years, if we'll ever see it. The Chinese are building 12,000 miles, a half a trillion dollars, $400 to $500 billion. It's been this incredible initiative. It's probably one of the largest public financing programs ever in human history. And it's been going really fast. Now, what ended up happening was last week in Wenzhou, in eastern China, two trains missed a signal, and they went smack into each other. And right now, 40 people dead. And the government's reaction was less than stellar. Now, what's usually the government's had has been able to control the narratives on these things. Excuse me, I'm coughing here. I'm going to go ahead and hit.
Are you getting
sorry about
some
that. Just got and so the Chinese censors are really effective. So and what's in 4 minutes after that crash, the first tweets went up, and they're not tweets because they're banned in China. It's on the microblogs went up, and they were just consistently pounding the official narrative coming out. We've had 26 million microblogs put up. There's 340 million.
Do you want to go get a glass of water, maybe?
No, I'm hanging in there.
Okay.
You know, but they have 340 million microbloggers in China, which is just massive on two different companies, Tencent and Sina Weibo. And really, this has been an incredible story to see how the Chinese government has been responding to the pressure coming from microbloggers.
Aren't they being watched, and censored?
Well, they are. The censorship can't keep up. You know, most of the censorship that happens on the Chinese web is not, you know, men with red pens who sit around looking through emails. It's done very Google-esque. You know, these are bots that are out there. And the language of the bots can't change fast enough to accommodate the situation. People are evolving their language very quickly to circumvent the bots and their programs.
The filters.
The filters, if you will.
So why are these services even allowed if you know, from the way I see it, if they're banning Twitter, why wouldn't they be banning other services too?
They don't. They're banning Twitter because they can't control Twitter. So what they're able to have a very close relationship with the companies who make them, and these services provide very useful kind of pressure valves that the Chinese government uses to release steam. And this is allows people to express themselves, and they've been incredibly sophisticated and effective at containing the dissent on the Chinese web, but they haven't been able to do it entirely. And what you're seeing in this, you know, in this train crash is the kind of cross section of lots of different societal issues coming together, mixed with a really connected population now. And that is proving to be very difficult for the government to manage. This is a case where, again, if you understand Chinese microblogging and kind of the power of the web, it's fascinating to watch.
So do you think this is actually good? I mean, they were challenging the government's narrative, saying everything's fine. These trains, you know, didn't really crash, or what was the deal there?
Pretend that the government says things are in control. So first of all, this was, and people are saying it's not being in control. They're trying to cover things up. They fired top railway people, and they didn't fire enough. And the people were saying this isn't going far enough. More importantly, they've set up a commission to look into it, but yet they put people who were from the railway ministry involved in prior crashes. And so the people said, this is not responsible. Bloggers came out and said, you know, why isn't the prime minister coming down here? The prime minister's office said, you know, he hasn't been feeling well. Prime Minister Wen Jiabao, who's really the kind of consoler in chief in China, he goes out and very effectively kind of, you know, he's called Grandpa Wen and hugs people in front of the cameras. And he wasn't there. And he was saying he didn't feel well. Then bloggers came out and found the pictures last week of him with Cameroonian President Paul Biya and him, you know, cutting ribbons here and there. So again, this is a real check on power that we haven't seen on the scale and speed and scope that is really unprecedented, in part because the Chinese web now is just so huge. You know, you're looking at 425 million people online, which is, again, it's the world's largest web population, and it's doing things we didn't anticipate.
Interesting. Well, maybe the internet is indeed the voice of the people, in these types of...
It is. It's a really interesting test case for what is just the nature of the internet. You know, in a situation where the government is the opposite of where it is in the Western world, in that it's trying to control it as much as possible.
Yeah, I really wouldn't have expected to see that kind of trend come out of China. I mean, with everything we're hearing about China and their approach to the internet, I'm actually very surprised that that the internet can become a way for the people to not just express themselves, but actually apply pressure on the government. So.
No, the internet's been for many years now has been a really active and dynamic place. Ai Weiwei, who of course is this artistic dissident, you know, he's been using Twitter, using proxy networks, to get around the censorship, but using Twitter. Han is another huge blogger out of Shanghai, who's also a Formula One race car driver. He's been, you know, very active in kind of criticizing. You just can't criticize the same way we do, which is in those direct terms. But there's a very vibrant web dissent movement in China that's able to live within the restrictions. And then, again, within the microblogging community, which is, you know, it's hard to call 340 million people a community. I mean, that's, you know, bigger than the population of the United States. You just have a scale which is incredible. That said, you know, I don't go as far. I'm a disciple of Evgeny Morozov, who wrote The Net Delusion, which is, you know, this idea that the web can be a tool for democracy and tool for openness. It can equally be a tool for suppression, and that's what we've also seen in China as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of both.
How many microblogging accounts in China?
340 million.
So that's 7 times Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, and growing fast, too. I mean, they're not even near their capacity yet, which is really quite amazing.
Is that a case of, and I'll be very brief because we have to sign off soon, is that a case of they're using them on their cell phones, so it's one of the main ways they're connecting to the internet, or do they all have computers?
No, there's a lot of access on computers, a lot of access. You know, 3G networks are rolling out across China, and it's just really the size of the population that and the connectedness to it. Their bandwidth has just skyrocketed up, and
almost a third of the population. It's a huge percentage because in our countries that are way more connected, you don't see these numbers at all.
So you're about half the population of China now is online. So you're at about 500 million people, 425.
Online, yes, but I'm talking about the Twitter equivalents.
Yeah?
It's a very large adoption rate.
It's huge.
I'm surprised.
It's huge.
All right. Okay, thank you very much, everyone, for joining me on this show. We will be back, of course, in a month. Before that, though, you can follow all of our wonderful hosts in their daily musings. And we'll start with Eric. Please, can you tell us where we can find you?
Sure. My China tweets are at EOLander, EOLANDER. And my tech tweets for on tech news, global tech news, is at Eric, E-R-I-C, F-24.
Oh, I'm not following you on Eric, F-24.
Well, there you go.
I'm going to do that right now. Thanks a lot for being here, Eric. It's really nice to have your input on things and to have a largely professional gentleman correct us when we say things, silly things.
It's been great. I've really enjoyed it.
Turkey, people know where they can find you, but please say it again.
It's at twitter.com/Saudi.
Excellent. Concise, precise, beautiful. That's what I like. Tom, what about you?
I have an absolutely ridiculous Twitter name. So if you just go to twitter.com/TomMerritt and look at the posts, it'll tell you how to spell my actual Twitter name that I use.
And of course, Tom is hosting TNT every day out of the new newly completed Tweet Brick House. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks for helping us test out this week.
I didn't tell you that, but I told Jason, actually, when I first tested this new video system, I didn't realize that when you click on the invite, you're actually broadcasting to the studio. Now, you're not live, of course, but people at the receiving end on the studio can see you. And I wasn't, let's say, completely clothed when I clicked on it.
And I didn't see, thank goodness, but I heard.
NSFW, okay. NSFW.
So yeah, I was very surprised to see all of you guys. It was the live portion of the feed, and Ayaz turned his head just as I came. You know, I saw the screen, so I thought, oh my god, is he seeing me? And then I, you know, hoped he would, because never mind. All right, let's
You're
move on.
You're an engaged
on.
Man, Patrick.
I am. And so, yes, we will be back. Sorry, I have a friend who's coming over, and I'm getting very confused at the moment because we have to finish the show. But I still want to tell everyone listening, thank you so much for listening. Sorry again for not being here last month, but I'm sure we will be back next month with another set of very interesting hosts. If you want to let us know how you feel about this show and correct us for being too liberal or just too silly, please do so by coming on the article of the blog at thefeliusclub.com. And please let us know how you feel about these topics and more. If you want us to talk about other things in the future, you can also let us know that over there. We'll be back in a month. Thank you very much for listening, and talk to you soon. Bye.
Visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.